Okay, I hope you got the lyrics of this song, God Save the Queen by the Sex Pistols. I'm now trying to get to my PowerPoint. Okay. God Save the Queen, the fascist regime. The song by Sex Pistols emblematized the 1970s as a decade that saw the rise and power of punk music. It is also an idea that I'm going to suggest that is quite central to the portrait of 1970s London that Hanif Qureshi draws in the novel. The 1970s, I know the last previous weeks you've been thinking about the 1950s as producing a new subculture, a new category of the teenager. In this unit, temporally and historically, we move to the 1970s, perhaps another historical turning point. And to think about the 1970s in different ways than we have been discussing historicity and the relationship of history and literature. The 1970s can be considered to have been a decade of economic crisis that sparked national anxieties and anxieties about the self, society, nation. A decade of the crisis of the welfare state as large-scale unemployment hit almost all sections of society. 1970s was also a decade in which the radical energies of the 1960s counterculture began to seem effete and powerless. The 1960s, if you know anything about that radical decade, was the decade of students' movements, student sit-ins, takeovers of universities, the anti-war movement, the women's movement, militant civil rights movements in the United States and elsewhere, new left movements, right? So 1960s, have been memorialized as the decade of rebellion, of protest, of revolution. So 1970s, coming on the heels of that moment, in retrospect, seems to be a decade in which some of those radical energies begin to seem to be on the wane, losing their power. Okay? And instead, what you get in the 1970s, and again, a kind of interesting comparison with the previous novel that we have been discussing in our groups, is that the 1970s, while not sort of necessarily introducing new radical political movements, seem to have spawned rebellious subcultures and youth cultures. Okay? As evidenced in fashion, and you see, when you read the novel, the different ways in which the novel registers changes in fashion. So you have, bell bottoms, Levi's jeans, music, advertising, drugs, experimental sex and sexuality, mysticism, that, of course, by the time the 1980s came along, had become mainstreamed and co-opted. Nevertheless, in the 1960s, you see sort of the effervescence of new style, of new cultures. Okay? In music, too, you just heard a clip from the Sex Pistols, but in more generally, the progressive rock and hippie culture of the 1960s gave way to a grittier punk music in the 1970s. So that musicians like Bob Dylan, Syd Barrett, Kevin Ayers, Soft Machine, Rolling Stones, I don't know how many of these you're familiar with, Third Ear Band, Hawkwind, Beatles, Pink Floyd, the novel is replete with allusions and references to this music. By the 70s, is seen as too soft, right? As too alternative. And you see this registered in the novel as a movement against hippie culture and the rise of the punk movement. I'm going to briefly turn to a passage on the bottom of page 130 in my edition, and what I'll do is tell you the chapter from which I'm reading this. This is from chapter 9. Okay, and it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, about 6 pages from the beginning of chapter 9, page 130 in my edition, the bottom of it. When the shambolic group finally started up, the music was thrashed out. It was more aggressive than anything I'd heard since early Who. This was no peace and love. Here were no drum solos or effeminate synthesizers. Not a squeeze of anything progressive or experimental came from these pallid, vicious little council estate kids with hedgehog hair howling about anarchy and hatred. Okay? So a very different mood, a very different moment seems to be heralded in the novel, a grittier, more violent moment as symbolized by the introduction of punk music. At another place in the novel, this is referred to as the new nihilism, okay? The new hopelessness, the waning of hope in love and peace. Okay? In fact, fun is made of the Beatles song, All You Need Is Love. Okay? And what the novel registers is a distinctive cynicism of the 70s generation towards politics, towards political activism, and towards belief. Okay? So what I'm suggesting with this background is that the novel is about a very specific historical moment which marks a shift away from political fervor, political activism, from the belief in change and revolution into a dissipation of those radical energies. And one of the ways in which that dissipation occurs is in the evocation of new style, of new fashions, okay? And I think this in itself is one of the political points made by the novel, right, in terms of what happens to the generation after the 1960s and their political comments and their political beliefs, okay? I want to now argue that the novel, while it is focused on presenting this shift, this new nihilism, the novel juxtaposes this cynicism, this empty rebellion, against an enduring innocence and faith in progressive change and transformation. Okay? So the novel, I don't think, exactly buys into this nihilism and this cynicism, even as it registers it and represents it. I think the novel also presents the other side of this, which is a continuing hope and faith in change and transformation, social transformation. Because, of course, in the 70s, it's not that the movement of the 1960s just died out, right? There were elements of many of those radical progressive movements that continued into the 70s. The women's movement, the anti-racist movements on the ground, in fact, were gaining in popularity. In the novel, Jamila is one such character who, even though she's part of this new nihilistic generation, is also a committed feminist in her own way. If you remember, she reads Simone de Beauvoir, she listens to the blues, she's inspired by the African-American civil rights movements. Angela Davis, the famous academic and leader of the civil rights movement in the United States, is a big hero for her, right? So there are characters like Jamila who retain a faith in the possibility of social transformation. Along with this, I think you see, because most of the characters, or many of the characters, are young people, you see the idea of self-fashioning, therefore, is probed in ways that show that fashioning is much more than just wearing a particular brand of jeans or listening to a particular music group. In fact, the changing fashion becomes only a superficial manifestation of a changing identity. And here you have in the novel the idea of, how do I change the arrows? Just click. Oops. Okay. Yeah. Okay. It didn't. Okay. The idea that self-education was important, right? And in a way, self-education was predicated on checking out of the system. And here again, you kind of see the remnants of the 1960s radical students' movements that questioned, you know, the university, the structures of classrooms, the curriculum, etc., when everything was up for questioning. I think that idea is very much present in this novel as well. The idea that real education comes not in the classroom, right, but through a kind of self-education, by in fact questioning the system. And of course, you know, in the novel as well, you see evidence that education did not do much for the working classes. And in fact, education, for many, signified a solidifying of class divisions. And the ways in which the system feeds into creating hierarchical class distinctions through the education system. So the education system itself is seen as propagating hierarchies and class divisions. And that, of course, we continue to see to this day. What the tension around the whole question of education is that for the immigrant characters in the novel, right, this view of the cynical view of education or the educational system comes up against immigrant aspiration, for which education is the vehicle for class mobility, right? So for these young immigrant children, education on the one hand is repressive, but on the other hand is a way out of their their marginalized position. Okay, so here I have two quotes from the novel. The title I've given to this section is "We Don't Want No Education." Does anybody know which song this, which group this is taken from? Pardon? Pink Floyd. Oh, I'm glad you all know that. Okay. And the two quotes are, the first one is from chapter 7. "The education system and I had split up. It would break his immigrant heart too. But the spirit of the age among the people I knew manifested itself as general drift and idleness. We didn't want money. What for? We could get by living off parents, friends, or the state." The state here, the reference to the welfare state, which, as I said, you know, is in crisis in the 1970s. So this sort of continuing rebellion against the system through an affect of drift and idleness. Right? This is not revolution or rebellion. Right? What is there in place of revolution is drift and idleness, is a checking out of the system, right? Rather than engaging with it or overturning it. The second quote, "Yeah, sometimes we were French, Jamie and I, and other times we went black American. The thing was, we were supposed to be English, but to the English, we were always wogs and nigs and parkies and the rest of it." Okay, I'll come back to this quote in just a moment. But what I want to reinforce is this idea that it is in this decade of crisis that I've spelled out here that Karim is coming of age. So in that sense, The Buddha of Suburbia can be seen as a classic novel of coming of age. And in fact, but I think what makes it specifically so interesting is the particular historical moment in which Karim is coming of age. He is, of course, caught between immigrant desires for upward mobility. His father says, "Oh yes, he'll be a leading doctor in London," and the desire to break free, and in doing so, to belong, to partake in what was to be young then. Okay, so that, in a way, is one of the central crises within Karim, right? He needs to make it in the system, and at the same time, he wants to break free of what he sees as a repressive system. Immigrants then were the ones who could ironically slide between class positions to a greater extent in a society still very mired in older class distinctions. So what's also interesting in the novel is that you have sort of traditional British society, right, which seems to operate under very sort of set class lines and class hierarchies. And then you have groups of immigrants who, as in the second quote, you know, are able to take on different identities, right? Perform different identities, even, of course, as the gritty reality remains that for the English, they are nothing but wogs and nigs and parkies. Okay? So this is shown repeatedly, you know, this tension between established British society and the immigrants in this society throughout the novel. If you remember Pike's exercise when he's working with a group of actors to talk about their lives and where they see themselves fitting in. Karim's own class position is quite interesting. His mother is white, but working class. His father is Asian, but upper middle class in India. And of course, loses class status once he comes to Britain and becomes working class in Britain. Among the British, the English characters as well, you have Eva, who's middle class, bohemian, Eleanor, who's upper class, right? So the question of class then, you know, is quite central to a reading of this novel in terms of its diagnosis of the crisis of the 1970s and what is happening to what people previously might have thought were distinct class identities and categories. So this seeming malleability and maneuverability of class positions, as signified in the second quote, we were French when they were reading Simone de Beauvoir, or when they read Angela Davis, they become Black American. The tension between that and the limits of the English nation, right, provide the novel with the central tension. Okay, so the idea that you can forge your own self, you can fashion your own self, right, that against the fixity, the rigidity of English society, and you place that within a decade that is full of different kinds of crises. I want to go to the next slide. Yeah. Okay. This is the next section I want to cover in the lecture. Okay. On page 40 of the novel, Harry Back says to Karim, "We are with Enoch." Okay. I don't know how many of you have heard of Enoch Powell, but the reference is to the conservative politician Enoch Powell, who gave a very infamous speech called the Rivers of Blood speech. The speech has become known as the Rivers of Blood speech. I'll just read a section from it. Should I try the YouTube clip? Will it? Okay, yes, you don't need to copy this. We will post this online, okay? Okay, so this is the speech given by Enoch Powell in April 1968, signaling what was to come, the 1970s, as a decade of racial trouble and racial conflict. He says, "Here is the means of showing that the immigrant communities can organize to consolidate their members, to agitate and campaign against their fellow citizens, and to overawe and dominate the rest with the legal weapons which the ignorant and the ill-informed have provided. As I look ahead, I'm filled with foreboding. Like the Roman, I seem to see the river Tiber foaming with much blood, that tragic and intractable phenomenon which we watch with horror on the other side of the Atlantic." He's referring to blacks getting their rights in the United States of America, but which there is interwoven with the history and existence of the states itself, is coming upon us here by our own volition and our own neglect. It has all but come. In numerical terms, it will be of American proportions long before the end of the century. Only resolute and urgent action will avert it even now. Whether there will be the public will to demand and obtain that action, I do not know. All I know is that to see and not to speak would be the great betrayal." This particular quote is very coded. The entire speech is actually available. You can look it up on the web. But he's referring here to what he's foreboding Britain about, which is about a tidal wave of immigrants, right, who are going to come and inundate Britain, take over British society, and ultimately to destroy it. Okay. Of course, we know very recent reverberations of this speech and its continuing significance in the ways in which, you know, the far right in Britain continues to see Enoch Powell as one of their intellectual forebears, right? Somebody who forewarned Britain about the coming in of immigrants. Okay, the novel, of course, is very much implicated in this whole issue of racism and racial tension of the 1970s. The novel depicts the rise of racism in the 1970s. You have skinheads, neo-fascist groups, the National Front, the firebombing of Asian and black homes and shops, beatings, racial slurs, and abuse. Okay? All of that is very vividly represented in the novel. And by the way, if you're interested in Qureshi's work, he has also worked on several screenplays of films such as Sammy and Rosie Get Laid, My Beautiful Laundrette, and The Black Album, which is running here in the Warwick Arts Center, all of which, you know, depict this particular tension, this particular crisis within the British state. Okay? And of course, as now, the 1970s too are a decade in which the context of economic trouble and rising immigration together, right, contributes to this political and racial crisis. Okay? So the next point I want to make is that the novel, I'm arguing, is an attempt by Qureshi to draw new maps of Englishness, right? That the novel is questioning, who is English? How do we define Englishness, right? Who belongs? Who's the inheritor of Britain's history and its traditions, okay? So the novel can be read as engaged in drawing new maps of English. In many ways, I read this novel as a novel in the long tradition of the immigrant novel written in Britain, going back to 1934, to Jean Rhys's novel Voyage in the Dark, about a young Caribbean, white Caribbean girl, a chorus girl coming to Britain, Sam Selvan's Lonely Londoners, published in 1956, V.S. Naipaul's Mimic Men from 67, Timothy Moore's Sour Sweet, Salman Rushdie's The Satanic Verses, published in the year before The Buddha of Suburbia. And, of course, followed by writers, more current writers, such as Andrea Levy, Monica Ali, and Zadie Smith. All of these writers and books can be seen as attempts to rethink the very question of Englishness. And I think it also perhaps has relevance to what we study, you know, in our curriculum and in this course, in the English department here at Warwick. I think there are sort of, deep connections between the way in which we think of Englishness and English literature. So the whole myth of homogeneity, right, that, you know, hegemonic Englishness tries to set up, you see that being torn up as a new nation, Qureshi records, is being forged out of the rubble of colonialism. Okay, so coming on the heels of the end of colonialism, right, in the 1940s and 1950s, you have a new nation coming into being, and therefore the imperative to rethink what is the British nation, right, and what is Englishness and Britishness. One of the quotes from the novel is the line, "The immigrant is the everyman of the 20th century." And so we see in the novel the juxtaposition of immigrant hybridity with racist homogeneity, of immigrant multiculturalism with suburban anomie and sameness. Okay? So what I'm arguing is that the novel shows the figure of the immigrant, right, as the figure of the everyman, right, the figure that embodies all of the cultural, political, and social tensions of the 20th century, right, the century in which colonialism first reaches its peak and then dissipates, right, and then ends after the Second World War and leads up to new immigrants coming into the formerly colonial countries. And the position that the novel takes is on this issue is by presenting a set of oppositions, right? So you have immigrant hybridity, the quote that I just read, you know, where he talks about taking on a French identity or a black identity, the fact that immigrants, even as they are marginalized, can move between different cultural identities, and the homogeneity, right, demanded by racists, right, that Asians should be Asians, blacks should be blacks, etc. The contrast between immigrant multiculturalism and the suburban anomie and sameness and blankness out of which Karim is coming out. Okay? The quote, "Perhaps it is the odd mixture of continents and blood, of here and there, of belonging and not, that makes me restless and easily bored. Or perhaps it was being brought up in the suburbs that did it." Okay? So the novel then can be seen as a statement against dullness, right? Or Karim as a figure who's questioning dullness. He's questioning anomie. It's questioning sameness. And here, the shift out of, the move out of the suburb into the city, into London, right, becomes a flight into temptation. Okay? And there are various passages in the novel that show Karim coming face to face with the gritty realities of London, the slums in London. He sees them for the first time when he comes into the city as a young man, where the black people lived, right? So the grittiness, the poverty, the marginalization of slums, of immigrant ghettos in the city. At the same time, the sense of energy, of cosmopolitanism, of style, right? London as the city of books, record shops, counterculture, all the things that young people love, okay? He finds that in London, in opposition to the completely antiseptic life that he has led in his suburban home. So that home in the suburb then becomes a leaving place. That's another phrase from the novel. Okay. Now, of course, there are lots of other issues for migrants that the novel talks about, where race, class, and gender intersect in a dangerous mix. And here I want to sort of very briefly turn our attention to Jamila, who, of course, as we know, is, I think there's a question around that, whether she's been forced into her marriage with Changez. And there you get a glimpse of not just immigrant rebellion or immigrant energies, but also immigrant conservatism, right? As you have Anwar turning more and more Muslim, more and more conservative, more and more religious. And of course, this is shown very much in the context of white racism, right? So there's a way in which the novel shows the dynamic interrelationship between the far-right racists, such as the National Front and others, who want Britain to be a completely white country, right? And the ways in which that racism pushes some minorities into positions of increasing conservatism, right, into closing ranks. And I think the point about Jamila is that, of course, women become the worst victims of this tension between the white racists and the minority religious conservatives, right? Because it's on the question of marriage, it's on the question of women's sexuality that in a way the battle lines are drawn. Okay, so this whole idea of performing identity, then, that the novel takes up, the metaphor of theater in the novel, for instance, I found very interesting. The fact that Karim aspires to be an actor and succeeds in doing so to an extent, right, then brings up questions of stereotypes and impersonation. And I'm here thinking particularly of Karim's impersonation of Anwar and the moment in which he falls into the stereotype when he's impersonating Anwar, representing sort of the Asian man. And juxtaposed with that, of course, you have Jean, the young West Indian actor, right, who has a lot of trouble getting roles in the theater scene in London. Okay, so there's a great deal of conflict then around this whole thematic of identity in the novel. Right, on the one hand, it seems very pliable, very manipulable. The characters move between different identities. They perform different identities for different purposes. On the other hand, the political reality of fixed identities, right, of adhering to very stable identities, that tension is there throughout the novel. Okay, of course, a flip side of the racism of the ultra-right that the novel shows is the liberal, what I'm calling the liberal orientalism, okay, which the novel, I think, shows can also be dangerously close to racism. And here, of course, Eva's whole obsession with Buddhism and with Oriental mysticism and Oriental philosophies, right? The question is whether it is a deep-seated engagement or does it become just a caricature, a commodification, you know, of the East? And of course, the novel tracks the longer history of this Orientalism. André Gide is mentioned and his desire for Oriental men. The father himself turns into an exotic for consumption by others. Karim, in the play that he's offered, is cast as Mowgli. Remember that? So there's a kind of... there's a kind of complication, right, on this whole issue of racism and racial discrimination. On the one hand, you have the far right, right, wanting to eliminate all traces of blackness from Britain, right? On the other hand, the other strain of that racism is this commodification, right? Is this turning the Orient into a fetish? And for the immigrants, I think the novel shows that both are very dangerous, right? If the black person makes himself into a commodity for consumption by the mainstream white society, okay. In the remaining time, there's lots more to talk about. Here are another two quotes where the characters are sort of talking about this whole idea of authenticity, right? What is real identity and the imperative to perform particular identities in different situations, okay? Now, of course, when Karim actually does arrive in London, to live in London, he finds himself directionless, right? The city is vertiginous with possibility, a phrase from the novel. At the same time, the city becomes a place of self-knowledge for Karim. Okay? So continuing this idea of the city as a space of energy, of style, it is also then the space of self-knowledge, of discovering who he is. And of course, the novel, and I'll just come back to this at the end, the novel, as the plot moves on, of course, gestures to the end of the 1970s, the decade of the 1970s, and the moving towards the neoliberal era of Margaret Thatcher taking over as the British Prime Minister. And so that the novel tracks through the 70s the changes in the space of London, okay, as spaces of alternative culture, of revolution and rebellion become increasingly commodified, right? There's property speculation that is rife, people living in squats, and class and racial tensions coming together in a very, very vibrant but also dangerous mix. Okay. I want to sort of now turn to the resolution actually and the structure of the novel actually just before I end. By the end of the novel, Karim is turning 20, and the future seems to be open for him. What is interesting for me, particularly in reading this novel, is that more than what Karim does himself, the novel shows what he observes, right? And Karim seems to be an observer of other people's charisma, intelligence, wit. And the distinctions he makes between interesting and nice people. There are interesting people and there are nice people. Okay. And I think ultimately, Karim's growing up in the novel, perhaps one could argue, is growing up about, or his growing up is about coming to terms with his mixedness, right? With the fact that he is a mixed character, he's a mixed person. Okay. I think this was a previous one. No. Okay. I think that's been left out. As he says in chapter 14, but I did feel, looking at the strange creatures now, the Indians, that in some way these were my people, and that I'd spent my life denying or avoiding that fact. I felt ashamed and incomplete at the same time, as if half of me were missing, and as if I'd been colluding with my enemies, those whites who wanted Indians to be like them. Partly, I blamed Dad for this. Okay? So this whole question of how does the novel resolve this tension, this dilemma of who Karim is, and the ways in which he can exist and perform various identities in 1970s Britain, I think is brought to a narrative resolution in the novel by a coming to terms with this mixedness, by a coming to terms, by an acceptance of who he is and where he has come from. But I think that instead of sort of lapsing into a faith in essential identities, the novel nevertheless retains a faith in the whole notion of identity as a performance. Okay, in the two quotes here, we became part of England and yet proudly stood outside it. But to be truly free, we had to free ourselves of bitterness and resentment too. How was this possible when bitterness and resentment were generated afresh every day? And then Eva says about the play was about this country, about how callous and bereft of grace we've become. It blew away the self-myth of tolerant, decent England. What's interesting for me is that the novel, after having shown various sources of tension and conflict, in the end seems to come to a quite a neat closure, right? The emphasis here on civility, the emphasis on freeing ourselves of bitterness and resentment. Eva's notion that if only we were more graceful, right, and more tolerant, perhaps there could be a future. I think this might lead one to think about the political commitments or the political position that the novel is taking. Because after all, from a conventional reading, the novel seems to fall into the conventional structure of a comedy, right? In the end, he returns home to the father, to family, albeit in a different arrangement. There's a marriage, there's childbirth, there's no revolution. If you remember, at the end, there's a demonstration in South Hall, right, that's going on, that Jamila is part of, against the National Front. And Karim very casually says, I didn't go for it. Right, he doesn't. He sort of does not make himself a part of that collective. Okay, so the question then is that does the novel endorse, in a way, this kind of very lukewarm response, after all, to the racial tension, the economic and political crises of the 90s, of the 1970s, by offering a kind of rather liberal notion of decency, civility, politeness, and tolerance. The idea that if only we just got along better, if only we were just more tolerant of each other, the world would be a better place. I think that the novel certainly represents this position, right, via Karim, the protagonist. But I think that the novel leaves a lot more open-ended for us to question Karim's investment in this perhaps new ideology of Englishness, which is a multicultural ideology of Englishness. That Englishness, in fact, is actually quite open and can absorb and take in different identities without really ruffling feathers, without really changing actual structures. I think Qureshi's novel is about the possibilities that are inherent in youth culture, those that had animated the decade of the 1960s and going on into the 1970s, and the reality of the subsumption of those possibilities, right? The weakening of those possibilities in commodity culture, in liberal capitalism, and in the neoliberalism of the Margaret Thatcher era. Remember that this novel is written in the 80s. It's published in 1990. So he's looking back at the decade of the 1970s from the perspective of the 80s, right? In which, you know, Margaret Thatcher's regime brought about, you know, such a definitive conservatism, both socially and politically, but also economically, right? The privatization, you know, of various aspects of the state, etc. Okay. So in that sense, I think that in spite of the narrative of resolution, in which everything falls into place, and Britain can possibly be a country which will accommodate through the tolerance of the majority communities, the majority races, that in spite of that, I think that this is, it can be read as a progressive novel, okay? Because of the ways in which it shows the historical shifts, the ways in which it remains authentic to the spirit of the times that it is recording, but also shows what happens to radical politics when they come up against the forces of capitalist commodification. Okay, so in a way, the novel perhaps can equally be read as about the dangers, you know, of an increasingly commodifying world, okay, as represented in the Thatcher regime that takes over at the end of the novel's time. Okay, so I'll stop there. Thank you.